This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Allison Liotta spent 12 years prosecuting domestic violence and sex crimes in Washington, D.C. Often she'd come home from work and say, somebody should write a book about this. When she became pregnant with her first child, she realized that what free time she had was about to disappear, so if she wanted to try her hand at writing, it was now or never. Allison quit her job as a federal prosecutor in 2011 and is now an acclaimed author, commonly dubbed the female John Grisham. She just released her fourth novel about a federal prosecutor named Anna Curtis. It's called A Good Killing. Allison's going to read from her book at Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight at 7. Joins me now on The State of Things right here, Allison Liotta. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about your decision to leave the courtroom and become a writer.
It was a hard decision. I was a prosecutor for 12 years. I come from a long line of prosecutors. My dad was a federal prosecutor in Detroit. My husband was a federal prosecutor in Baltimore. It really was in the blood. But after the first book, Law of Attraction, Simon & Schuster asked me to keep writing. And that was one of the best moments of my entire life, when I was asked to continue this series featuring this sex crimes prosecutor. And I knew I just had to seize that moment.
And was it really you're sort of churning over these real experiences you're having as a prosecutor, saying, you know, these could be, somebody should write a book, right?
Absolutely. The things that I saw in D.C. Superior Court just blew my mind every day. I thought at some point I would reach at the point where I would stop being surprised, but I never did reach that point. Just the capacity for human evil and also the capacity for good and helping, the spirit among neighbors, the service that prosecutors and police bring to their communities, and just seeing the courage of victims to face the person who did the worst thing that they could do to them. So I was thinking about it all the time.
People seem surprised when they hear that lawyers, you know, become writers. But it seems to me, especially courtroom lawyers, I mean, that's your job, right, is to frame a story.
It's all about storytelling.
Yeah. So tell us about these stories. You have written four novels now that feature Anna Curtis. Tell us more about her.
Well, she is a sex crimes prosecutor in Washington, D.C. No big surprise there. Each of the books are standalone, so A Good Killing, you can just jump right in there. But this is her most personal book yet. In the first three, she was dealing with all these crimes in Washington, D.C. But in A Good Killing, she goes home to represent her own sister, who's charged with murder. And not just murdering anyone, the local high school football coach in a town that loves its football. So the deck is already kind of stacked against her when she gets home. And it's even more stacked when she realizes her sister is not telling her the truth.
This is a story that also was perhaps inspired by headlines.
Absolutely. There were a lot of cases that I tried where the monster is not the stranger lurking in the bushes. We all worry about that. But so often, in about 80% of the cases, it's someone the victim knows, very often someone the victim trusts, someone who uses that trust to get access. So the cases that you hear about, cases like Jerry Sandusky or the Steubenville rape case, where it's somebody you know or like, somebody who might be the most respected community leader is the monster. And to me, that's a scarier monster because you don't know to run away.
You are trying in some ways to illuminate these courtroom experiences, the real life experiences that you've had. Tell us about that first book. Take us back and talk about the things that you were trying to illuminate there.
In Law of Attraction, one of the key plot points is this real life interaction in domestic violence cases where 80% of the victims are back together with their abuser by the time of trial and don't want to testify against them, don't want the prosecution to be brought. And the prosecutor has to make a decision on the spot. Are you going to try to bring the case despite the victim's wishes not to go forward? Or do you risk seeing her next time in a body bag if you don't go forward? And that is just a decision that kept me up nights. And I think if you have a nightmare like that, that maybe those are the seeds for your first novel.
Not only the kind of professional quandary that it leaves you with, should I go forward without the witness or not, but just the other turmoil that it leaves you in watching this human drama, a woman who has been severely beaten and hurt coming to you asking for help. And then 4 days later, you have a different story.
Absolutely. It was heartbreaking to watch. And it was especially heartbreaking to see the kids in those situations, because that cycle of domestic violence tends to repeat itself. And I always worried if I didn't somehow find a way to put a stop to it now, would that cute little girl with pigtails, that 7-year-old, was she destined to repeat that in the future?
So that's the genesis of the series itself, these kinds of questions that stirred. And then, as you say, you make it much more personal in your latest book, A Good Killing. Tell us, give us a plot summary.
Well, it's a mystery. It's definitely got a lot of romance in it as well. Anna goes home to Detroit to defend her sister, and her sister is not telling her what happened. A lot of defense attorneys find that the least reliable place to get your information is from your own client. But it's even harder when that is your own sister. And Anna both has to struggle professionally to figure out what's going on and personally to wonder what happened to her sister and what has her sister done. And in the end, how far will she go? How far will you go to save her sister?
You give her sister, Jody, her own voice in this book, and you have sections where she is simply talking directly to us. She's the narrator.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you to read, and I think you begin with a section in Jody's voice.
I do. This is the very beginning of the book in Jody's voice, chapter one. When I was 15, my favorite place in the world was the high jump set up at the school track. The bar provided a simple obstacle with a certain solution. You either cleared it or you didn't. In a world of tangled problems with knotty answers, that was bliss. I guess it all started out on that field, the summer before my sophomore year. That's when I fell in love with Owen Fowler. I never could hide how much I wanted that man. That's why everyone immediately thought I murdered him. Watch any TV crime show and the person who says, "I couldn't have killed him, I loved him," is the one who did it. Nothing fuels hate like love gone wrong. So when the coach went up in flames, people naturally looked to see if I was holding the match. But I swear, I didn't kill him. You don't believe me, Annie. I can see it in your eyes. But I'll tell you everything, exactly how it went down. You probably won't agree with what I did. You definitely would have done things differently. But by the end, I hope you'll at least understand.
Author and former federal sex crimes prosecutor Allison Liotta reading from her latest book, A Good Killing. Allison will be reading from that book at the Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight at 7 o'clock. Tell us about this decision to give Jody her own voice here and speak to us directly.
I think Jody was one of my more intriguing characters. Fans kept telling me, more Jody, more Jody. And she was. She and Anna are so different from each other. They're, as you find in a lot of families, you find these two sisters who will be just completely different personalities, approaches to the world. And this story, A Good Killing, is really in many ways Jody's story. I wanted to talk about things from her point of view, the point of view of the girl who's tough, the younger sister who is more proactive and tougher, but also has these secrets that Anna has never heard about before. And I'll tell you, this writing Jody's voice was some of the easiest, fastest writing I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah, it was a surprise.
Well, when you, I would think, again, as a prosecutor, any attorney, as a defense lawyer, I mean, again, that's the problem, right? Story A, story B, story D, and if you're the judge and the jury, you're trying to put all of them together. There's a lot of mismatch. So I guess in some ways that's been your job, is taking mismatched stories, putting them together between the, you know, between the covers and figuring out, you know, how this thing's going to sum
what
up.
What is the truth?
Yeah.
Yes, it's like taking those little sheets of vinyl, blue, red, yellow, putting them all together, and finally there's that whole picture.
And yet there are really aspects of the truth, elements of detection and the criminal justice system that are interesting to you. I think one of the real life elements that has drawn you to this novel was the rape kit backlog, a backlog in actually certifying those rape kits.
Yes, this is a real and scandalous problem in America. I've made it a plot point in my book because I really love books that teach while they're entertaining. You walk away and say, I learned something. In the United States, there are an estimated 400,000 rape kits that are sitting on police shelves untested. Of course, these are the swabs that are taken from victims of sex crimes in the immediate aftermath of the attack. And if they're tested for DNA, oftentimes they are worth their weight in gold. But because of lack of funding, because of apathy, because of kind of just a, you know, historically over time they've sat there, there are these kits sitting there. When they are tested, the results are incredible. Detroit found that they had 11,000 untested rape kits. They started slowly going through the backlog. After 1,600 tests, they found 100 serial rapists.
When you say untested, what do you mean?
They are, the swabs are taken. They're like a Q-tip. Yeah. They're put in a box, and then they're literally put on a shelf in a warehouse, and that is it.
So,
there are no DNA tests done.
Well, I wonder if I can get you to read another section from the book.
Absolutely. In this section, Anna comes home. She is hoping to find Jody and learns Jody is at a police station being interrogated. Anna asks to see her sister and is told she can't go in. And so Anna claims that she is Jody's lawyer and is finally brought to the interrogation room where she sees Jody and this officer sitting talking to each other. The officer was Rob Gergeron, Anna's high school boyfriend. 10 years ago, he'd been a lean, mean, borderline gorgeous quarterback. Now he wore a mustache, a short-sleeved shirt and tie, and 30 extra pounds. The cocky kid who used to sneak beer into parties had been transformed into a staid authority figure. Their relationship in high school had been short and intense and badly ended. He was not the person Anna wanted interrogating her sister. Jody, for her part, appeared surprised but not overjoyed to see Anna there. She didn't stand up. Anna looked from her scowling sister to her smirking ex-boyfriend. What is going on? It's nothing, Jody said. It's under control. I'll meet you outside. She was the last person to see him alive, Rob said, so she's a suspect. Did you hear that, Jody? Anna said. You're a suspect. I'm sure once I talk to Rob, he'll realize he has nothing to suspect me of. Doesn't always work that way, Anna said. As your lawyer, I advise that you consult with me before you say anything else to Officer Gergeron. My lawyer. Jody looked at Anna for a long moment. I like that. Do I get to boss you around? The opposite. I get to boss you around.
Allison Leota reading from her latest book, A Good Killing. She's going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight at 7 o'clock. When you created, a lot of this has to do with your real-life experience as a prosecuting attorney, but a lot of it isn't. You made people up. And even Anna, who may be a sex crimes prosecutor, apparently had a far more interesting life than you.
Absolutely. I couldn't write a novel about myself. I'm not interesting enough to lead a novel.
But how did you – were those characters rattling? I mean, all of a sudden you say, okay, I'm the they that has to write this book that they should write. Were you suddenly confronted with, but who are my characters? Or had these characters been emerging in your own imagination?
They began to emerge as I started to write about them. And then by the end of the first draft, they're fully formed. And then you can go back and write it again now that you really know your characters. But, you know, in the courthouse, you see such a spectrum of humanity, just every possible shape, size, and personality that there is. And so I just took the most interesting parts of all the detectives, prosecutors, criminals that I saw and brought them to the page.
You also write a blog, the Primetime Crime Review. Tell us about that.
I watch the TV crime dramas and I talk about what they're getting right and wrong. And it's very cathartic. I used to just throw popcorn at the TV. This is much more rewarding.
They get it right fast, right? I mean, what are some – because we watch CSI. It's amazing how they know exactly what region of the small European country those mushrooms came from or whatever.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. They'll have like an autopsy and they'll look in the stomach and not only find that they were eating morel mushrooms but that they came from a specific organic farm in Argentina, and that's a major plot point. And part of the challenge of a prosecutor, a real-life prosecutor – is combating the expectations of jurors who come in expecting this magic Harry Potter science that they've seen on CSI.
That's interesting. So these programs are actually having some effect on the criminal justice system.
They call it the CSI effect, and we're all trained in it. As prosecutors, you're trained that jurors are going to come in and expect what they saw on TV, and part of your job is to immediately align those expectations with reality. From the moment you start questioning the veneer, the people who might serve as jurors, you're working to align those expectations.
Well, this is A Good Killing is your fourth novel in this series, and I wonder if the process of creating these characters and writing about it as fiction has changed the way you look back at your career and the way you handled, you know, some of those cases or how they appeared to you at the time.
I certainly wish I'd taken more notes. I loved my job. It was the most challenging and I think also the most rewarding legal job that I could have chosen. But I think the two just really dovetailed nicely with each other. Being a prosecutor gave me really incredible stories to tell. And being a writer made me a better prosecutor in some ways. It gave me an empathy with the victims. I always tried to be as sympathetic as possible to everyone who walked through my door. But there's something about the act of writing and sitting for stretches of time trying to be that person the survivor, the victim, that really draws that level of empathy.
So you truth squad on your blog when you look at the TV crime shows. How have your colleagues responded to your fictional literature?
They've been great. The response has been wonderful. Most people just ask if I will put them in, I'll use their name or kill them off in some gory way in the novels, which is fun. I did have to go through DOJ, through the Justice Department, to have my first novel reviewed, and that was fine. They were wonderful, actually, about it. But they had to review the whole thing, sex scenes and all, so it made for some awkward elevator rides after I knew that my boss had read those chapters.
But now that it doesn't go through that review and people are asking to be in your books.
Yes.
So, and also the transition from that first pregnancy and then writing, has your writing discipline changed at all?
It has, because I have to get my boys off to school now before everything changes after you have the kids. But it is, it's a very disciplined thing. You have to sit down and make sure you're writing every day. The rule is butt in chair. If it's not there, you're not really working.
Allison, what a pleasure. Good to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Allison Liotta is the author of A Good Killing. She's going to read from that latest novel at the Barnes & Noble in Cary at 7 o'clock tonight. You can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our intern is Andrew Tai. Brent Wolf is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.